Joe, how you doing?
Just fine, Tim. Standing solid and forthright, and haven't been evacuated in 2 weeks. So
there you go.
Really good, happy mood.
All right. So let's hope there's no drought this spring or summer, more wildfires or
no droughts, fires, floods, avalanches, frogs. It doesn't matter what they throw at us. We're like the Israelites, you know. I mean, we just somehow always escape the curses and end up in a good place.
Well, tonight you wanted to talk about, well, the true origins of the Nazi Party, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, NSDAP. Of course, the Nazi Party, that's as it's commonly referred to. That's what the English called it. So it kind of took hold. Is described by Wikipedia as a far-right political party in Germany that was active between 1920 and 1945 and practiced the ideology of Nazism or National Socialism. Its precursor, the German Workers' Party, existed from 1919 to 1920. The Nazi Party emerged from the German Nationalist, Racist, and Populist Freikorps, paramilitary culture, which fought against the communist uprisings in post-World War I Germany. The party was created as a means to draw workers away from communism and into the Volkisch nationalism. Initially, Nazi political strategy focused on anti-big business and anti-bourgeois and anti-capitalist rhetoric, although such aspects were later downplayed in order to gain the support of industrial entities. In the 1930s, the party's focus shifted to anti-Semitic and anti-Marxist themes. Of course, it developed pseudoscientific racism. Various theories were important to the doctrine of National Socialism. The Nazis propagated the idea of a people's community. Their aim was to unite racially desirable Germans as national comrades, while excluding those deemed either to be political dissidents, physically or intellectually inferior, or a foreign race. The Nazis sought to improve the stock of the German people through racial purity and eugenics. Of course, you know, they weren't unique in that. broad social welfare programs and a collective subordination of the individual, of individual rights, which could be sacrificed for the good of the state and the so-called Aryan master race. The party's leader since 1921 was one Adolf Hitler. I think most people know who he was. Was appointed Chancellor of Germany, or maybe they don't, Chancellor of Germany, by President Paul von Hindenburg on 30 January 1933. Hitler rapidly established a totalitarian regime known as the Third Reich. Following the defeat of the Third Reich at the conclusion of World War II in Europe, the party was declared to be illegal by the occupying Allied powers, who carried out a denazification program in the years after the war. So that's sort of a brief history of the Nazi parties, courtesy the good people at Wikipedia. So, Joe, what do you think of that summation?
Wow, I never actually read the Wikipedia description of Nazism. It's absolute nonsense and basically is propaganda. I think that the Jewish comedian Mel Brooks was closer to the flavor of the thing in the movie The Producers, when he sang, if you want to be a smarty, come and join the Nazi party. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course he was wearing a Gestapo outfit, you know, as they like to do, to lampoon the whole thing. Now, actually, the Nazi party actually comes, or at least the legal entity of the Nazi party, comes from the Tool Society. The Tool Society was the organization.
Joe, by the way, that's actually mentioned later on in the Wikipedia article, which I thought was interesting.
So I'm glad that they do mention it. Yeah.
But go ahead.
And,
I'm sorry.
But anyway, so this was the mechanical legal process of the Nazi Party, is that the Tool Society developed it. And then had a collection of people who had been influenced by the ideas in the Tool Society, supposedly, which were primarily occult ideas. I'll get into that. And it was a blending of National Socialism with this occult kind of understanding of the world. And I would argue that, in fact, there were two forces that were being, or actually perhaps three, that were being developed by one organization, and the Nazi Party was simply one of them. The other was Zionism and anti-Semitism, which was ultimately shared by both groups. It was promoted by the Zionists, but it was also obviously became a huge component of the Nazi Party. The whole journey begins, oddly enough, with Palmerston in the 1840s, as so many of these things do.
Him again.
But the thing is that what I'm actually going to lay out is that what was actually being done was the creation of a very organized system of control of using nationalism. And so Germany was basically, through various means, it was taken over, and the strong nationalist force held it in place. And the purpose of this was to create obedience, so that the soldiers would basically fight to the death. When you look at how Zionism was created by Freemasonry, right? Because this is not, as it's sometimes characterized, the British elites or the British royal family developing Zionism. I mean, this is not correct. Palmerston, Shaftesbury, and Charles Warren, the people I'm going to be talking about, all of them are Masons. Okay. And so for some reason, a group inside Freemasonry, because these are all very high level individuals, so it wasn't just common Freemasonry that was coming up with this idea of creating the Zionist movement. But this group did decide that they would do so. They would create the process by which the State of Israel would occur. And at that time, in the mid-19th century, say 1840, 1850, they had a huge problem they had to overcome, which was integration. Here in the United States, integration is sort of a force-fed, political correct concept. But there it was just happening naturally, at least in terms of Jews and Gentiles. There was, like, for example, in Germany, a marriage of Jews, as they can determine, by percentage of 60% to Gentiles. So you don't really have a lot of anti-Semitism evidently in play at this point. So you had the series of British Freemason iterations building up Zionism. One of them was this thing called the Quattro Coronati. It's a term for a lodge, a particular lodge that was very powerful. It was a research lodge, and the research that it was doing was in regards to ancient history of Israel. It had taken on the the movement that that Palmerston and Shaftesbury had begun when they made public statements that it was now time for the Jews to return to their homeland. And so Quattro Coronati was founded by this guy Charles Warren. He had been there digging, and this was a big thing to go to Israel and dig up the artifacts to prove the existence of ancient Israel, and also to basically Warren was there to do a survey to determine, you know, if it could be reconfigured as a nation. And he said, yes, we have to help the Jew return. The Bible says this is a good idea. We need at least 4 million Jews in this area in Israel to reestablish Israel. Now, this was a time when this is going on, mid-19th century, the British don't have any control over this area. It's part of the Ottoman Empire. So it's very, very peculiar. And then, of course, there's this peculiarity about why in the world the British royals would take on something as arcane as the creation of Zionism. As Freemasons, it makes a little more sense because the Freemasons are so focused on the rebuilding of the temple. And so this, as a Freemason project, at least, you know, it's not completely incoherent. Now, Quattro Coronati then is the basis for then Herzl, who then takes on Zionism as a separate project, focuses on it. And Herzl is always talking about the how useful anti-Semitism is, because the idea being is that that will give motivation for Jewish people in Europe to basically return to Israel and leave Europe and to go to this strange country with no resources based on these historical legends and religious stories, and then recreate the nation of Israel. So Herzl is receiving money directly from the groups involved in the Quattro Coronati. And so it's a pretty straightforward trajectory that the British elite Freemasons, for some reason, created the entire movement of Zionism, which led to the creation of Israel. And, of course, then the Balfour Declaration is the sum, you know, total of all of their efforts, and then that says that the British nation would look favorably upon the establishment of the of a Jewish nation. Now, what is strange is that the Quattro Coronati is also responsible for the creation of the Nazi Party. Okay, now this is very, very odd. Needs more sunlight on it, because what happens is a Pumbaa for the Quattro Coronati, his name is John Yarker. He is the supreme commander. You know, I don't have the titles, but he's 33rd degree, you know, high up Mason. And he decides that it's time to create a new branch of Freemasonry, and it's going to be an occult branch. And of course, Freemasonry had quite a bit of occultism in it, but Yarger wants to have this new one, which he calls Memphis and Mizraim. And it's going to be, for some reason, he has this idea that this will is necessary. And he then goes and he decides that in order to promote it, he's going to basically give an individual a lot of power. And so you now have this a woman named Helen Blavatsky. And she is given there's actually a written document which that Yeager created, which has in it the this promotion of Helen Blavatsky as not only as a Mason, but it says that she will. She says that we, the sovereign grand Mason and last degree, you know, by virtue of a high authority, do declare and proclaim our illustrious and enlightened brother. Now, that's an important point. I'm going to get back to that in a second. Helen Blavatsky, sublime elect Scotch lady, the grand elect, and then they talk about all of the accolades they give to her. Okay, so she gets this, she's set into motion by the Quattro Coronati, and they actually call her a brother, which, as far as I can tell, this is the only time a woman is ever given the title by Masonry. So that's the only one I can find. So she's very high up for some reason. Now, she creates a philosophy to contain this this new occult aspect of Freemasonry. And she calls it theosophy. That means the God knowledge. Now, God knowledge is an organization which is actually a kind of brand, virtually, for the individuals who are then related to the creation of the Nazi Party. Because Theosophy, she merges her organization with National Socialism that is being promoted by other Freemasons, the Bellamys. The Bellamys are in the United States. This is around 1880. One of them has written, there are two of them. One is they're cousins, and one has written a book I forget the title of it, but
Looking Backward?
Looking Backward, exactly. Looking Backward. And so Looking Backward is, even though no one knows about it today, it was one of the most powerful books in culture during the end of the 19th century. In fact, scholars who did reviews of books of this era and the power of culture that they had listed it second to Das Kapital, Marx's book. Mm. So it gives you an idea of like what we're talking about, how powerful. Now, oddly enough, even though there's no particular reason why the Bellamys, who are promoting the value of National Socialism, would do so, they become theosophists. So they have this combination of Theosophy and Freemasonry, right? They, for some reason, are buying into Blavatsky's combination of these two forces. Blavatsky also developed the idea of Aryan supremacy. Now, she wrote a book, The Secret Doctrine, which I think no one has ever gotten through. It kind of reminded me of Josephus's Wars of the Jews. I mean, it's just so boring. It's just impossible to plow through. But it's highly rational. It's like 500, 600 pages long. And buried away in there, she brings up the concept of the Aryan race. She's talking about races as kind of metaphysical forces, you know. And she brings back the concept of the Aryan race, which is the provenance is not completely clear, but apparently develops in India in Sanskrit, and it's, you know, perhaps a synonym for Europeans. But this is disputed, and no one really knows how Blavatsky gets the term, but she starts talking about the Aryans, and she talks about them as being racially superior. Okay, now this is amazing that you know, she has come up with this concept. It's sort of like when Lord Palmerston in 1842 said it's time for the Jews to return to the homeland, and the Jews scratched their head and said, "What are you talking about?" You know, it's like who's interested in this? Well, Blavatsky, it's the same thing. She comes up with this concept of the Aryan race, and she actually describes a bunch of races that are inferior to it. Okay, so anyway, this then is now she then influences a number of people, and I'm going to go into like some of them, but one of them is Sebattendorf, who is a Freemason, and he's also a theosophist. right? He's a follower of Blavatsky. Blavatsky also develops the Masonic swastika as her personal emblem of this aspect of her theosophical society. She has these things called the mystic brooches, and she has it on her letterhead. And it's the Nazi party version of the swastika. In other words, it's right angled and it's tilted at 45 yeah. degrees. Yeah. yeah. So she's got the, this is where this comes from. So when you look at the Wikipedia description of Nazism, it's, you know, it's really, I don't know. I mean, because the fact is that the National Socialism comes from the movement that the Bellamys were developing, which they took to Germany. They actually went to Germany and developed the beginning of the of what becomes the National Socialist movement. Let's just stop for a second. National Socialism is basically nationalism. It's the idea of creating a nation, right? So the same problem that the Freemasons in Britain were having in terms of their vision for Israel, the people who were going to create the Nazi party and have this organized Germany and Italy, they had the same problem. There wasn't much nationalism, right? It wasn't in motion. The people had the German language, but that was kind of actually more regional. The German nation really wasn't until after World War I, where, you know, when the lines became so sharply divided, it was a little less of a national force. And this was particularly the case in Italy.
Yeah, the one thing I also mentioned is Bellamy's brother. He's the one that penned the Pledge of Allegiance.
Exactly right, and not only that, not only the Pledge of Allegiance, but the armed salute.
Yes, until they
the armed salute, which was then adopted by the Nazi Party, comes from the National Socialists in the United States who developed the Pledge of Allegiance. This was the first time that U.S. We then changed it to a flag salute, which where people would put their hand over their heart or hold it to their forehead like as in a flag salute. But originally, the Bellamys had it in the same arm structure that then becomes used by the Nazi Party.
And so, just want to go back. You mentioned the development of German nationalism. It's important to the force of nationalism. It sort of grew out of the French Revolution because it was the rise of Napoleon. And when Napoleon seized power, he united France under the nationalist banner, sort of exporting the revolution. And it was the war, Napoleonic Wars, Austerlitz and Jena, the defeat of Austria and Prussia, which caused the collapse of the Holy Roman Empire, the defeat of the Prussians and these things. And then he installed this Confederation of the Rhine and the Grand Duchy of Warsaw and Piedmont, these vassal states. But really, the German nationalism was born as a reaction to French nationalism, which grew out of the French Revolution,
which was a Masonic project,
and then you had this throughout the 19th century. I think you roughly from 1819 up until 1870, you had the gradual unification of the German states. Bismarck and the Franco-Prussian War, you have Germany as a state, 1871. Same time, also Italy under Masonic auspices as well, being unified under Garibaldi and those people. And this is really a force, sort of a zeitgeist that's being created by the secret society.
Of course, that's right. That's the key, is that if you actually look at where the different aspects are coming from, you can see Masonry and Theosophy in every single case. And I'm going to go into why this is eventually giving us a very clear picture as to what is really happening, what the real history is. And I'm just going to, because you mentioned Garibaldi, I'm going to stop and just describe him for a second. Because before John Jager, who was the head of Quattro Coronati, the Freemason lodge, the research lodge of promoting Zionism, and then also set Nazism in motion, Jager created this particular brand of mysticism. He created these two aspects. One of them was Memphis. He called them Memphis and Mizraim. And But where did he get this concept from? Well, actually, he was using the work of Garibaldi. Garibaldi had actually developed these concepts. And so Quattro Coronati then picked up the Mason Garibaldi's work for the occult. Now, in Garibaldi's case, it's clear he wasn't just an Italian nationalist, right? He was trying to set all of the small vassal states in Italy into a unified situation. He kept, in his entire life, he kept trying to bring about a unification. In the same way that the elite British Freemasons are trying to unify Israel, and then Bellamy's nationalism ends up in Germany, right, where it becomes a focus of control. Garibaldi is also a theophist. He's not just a Freemason. See, it's this very particular strand of Freemasonry that you see in the Quattro Coronati with Zionism, that you see with Blavatsky, and then you realize it's coming into Italy, and you can see that this is impossible, really, when you think about how few individuals are involved in this. In Freemasonry in general, and then that the Theosophist version of Freemasonry is would just be a few hundred people, and yet I'll show that all of these individuals who are involved in the production of the Nazi Party, the different aspects of it, have this combination: the Bellamy's, Blavatsky, Garibaldi. These are all the people who are creating, if you look at the elements of the Nazis, if you look at National Socialism, if you look at the Salute, if you look at the swastika, they all come from this organization. And so there's something here that is not getting enough attention, because as we go forward, you'll see that it'll become just an overwhelming question here in a few seconds, because the financing of the project, if you look at how the Nazi Party, which was this tiny little apparatus, when Hitler takes it over, it has a background in the occult and, of course, in these Aryan racial ideas, right? But it has no money. But yet, in a few years, it becomes the most powerful political force in Germany. How does that happen? Well, the money is actually coming from Montague Norman. He is the one who is actually organizing the finances of the Nazi Party. He's working with a German Freemason whose name is Schacht.
Hamal Schacht, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Now, just to digress for a second, who is Schacht, whose incidentally middle name is Horace Greeley.
Yes.
so kind of parents had a sense of humor. Anyway, so Schacht is a Freemason, but it's from a very strange lodge. There's not much known about this guy. He's kind of buried, but he was at Nuremberg, and then he was one of the few people who wasn't convicted. Mm-hmm. But Schacht, my German is a little weak. He was a member of the lodge that was the first one that was permitted to exist after the Allied occupation, and was the only lodge that was actually in motion in Germany after the Allies had defeated the Nazis. So you can see there's something peculiar about this particular lodge. It's not known, but in any case, that is a fact. And so Montague Norman, he would meet with him. They had many, many meetings.
First of all, what's Montague Norman's position?
Okay, he is the head of the Bank of England.
That sounds very important.
It is very important. But beyond that, he also has a family investment banking firm. And it's called Brown Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
This is his family's investment banking company. They own it. He merges it with Averill Harriman, his organization, to become Brown Brothers Harriman.
And this is where Prescott Bush works for.
Which then, of course, you get into Prescott Bush. But moreover, if you look at here, it's Wikipedia time again. If you just go to, you know, Brown Brothers Harriman, look at the list of people who are Skull and Bones on the U.S. side. I mean, it's 100%. Well, it's 95% are Skull and Bones members. Now, bear in mind, we are in a post-911 world, and, you know, we saw Skull and Bones, I mean, George Bush Jr., of course, you know, during that particular operation, you look at the Kennedy assassination, and you just see the stench of Skull and Bones just everywhere. So the fact that that Montague Norman is merging with basically a Skull and Bones investment bank to create a financial entity which is able to then maneuver money to Germany, it's very telling, right? In other words, the obvious question is, are we dealing with another operation? Just a big one, right? The creation of World War II and, you know, creation of the Nazi Party. And I am absolutely sure that we are, because not only is Montague Norman a Freemason, but he's a theophist. Now, you see, this is really getting strange, because there's no particular reason that an investment banker would want to be something like a crazed theophist, because if you look at the actual philosophy that Blavatsky lays out in The Secret Doctrine, it's beyond crackpot, right? I mean, it's just completely crackpot. In fact, I'll go into why, with that, all that mysticism, all the damn mysticism, and all the Aleister Crowley is part of this whole thing. All of the mysticism we're suffering with is just it's just an op to confuse people. It's kind of giving them a metaphysical workers' paradise. It's Marxism, except using fantasy occult ideas. But the whole purpose of it, which was outlined by Blavatsky, was to create a world religious leader, right? So I'm going to go into some of Hitler's statements. Like what he actually said, because this is really what Blavatsky is trying to set up. This is what this whole process is all about.
Now, are you going to draw the connections between Brown Brothers Harriman and some of these German cartels?
But the thing is that there is a whole world of research about this. And I'm kind of in a different overview of something I think is people aren't.
No, but I think it's interesting that these.
But it's totally fascinating, absolutely, to go into it as to how they were able to maneuver the money into basically supporting the Nazi Party.
Yeah, IG Farben, which is a Warburg concern. And sure. You also have, you know, Fritz Thyssen and the Steelworks and these things. And so you have all this money there. They're heavily invested in Germany's rearmament and industrialization in the 30s at a critical time. And also the bankers are able to they cut off credit to Germany to collapse the economy to create the political hysteria and problems in Germany. Aids Hitler's rise to power. And as soon as Hitler comes to power, the credit flows again.
The idea is to create the chaos that the ruler, this religious ruler, can come forward. But they certainly know where it's actually going to all end. In other words, this is, you know, the war is just basically a kind of pageant to reduce population of the Germans and the Italians. It's absolutely clear, because you not only have this bizarre identifying marker of the theophist in Montague Norman, who is the Brown Brothers family investment banking guy, who's a financier running the Bank of England. And so he ran it for a longer period of time than anyone else ever did. I think he was in there for like 25 years. So yeah. he wasn't just powerful; he was the guy,
like 1919 to 1944, I think.
Yeah, exactly right. So he is like this incredibly long-standing and powerful force, and the idea that he would be interested in something as crackpot as theosophy is, I'm sorry, but it's just not believable. Now,
another point is Montague Norman also enters into this arrangement with Benjamin Strong, chairman of the New York Federal Reserve, which was stretching its legs at that point, hadn't gotten its sea legs yet as a central bank. But they entered this deal where the U.S. dollar would be overvalued to prop up. Would be inflated to prop up the value of the English pound, and because they wanted to maintain parity after the war, but they couldn't do that because it had been inflated. The only way they could maintain the illusion of parity was for the dollar to devalue itself, and this sets the stage for the, you know, the Roaring Twenties and the subsequent bust. And so these are the bankers that are setting the stage for the collapse, the global economic collapse of 1929 to 1931.
Right. And I just wanted to mention that when, you know, we talk about the Warburgs' participation in this, they were in thick as thieves in this whole process of funding the development of the Nazi armaments. And bear in mind, their participation is going on in the 30s. Mein Kampf had been published early in the 20s, right? So you have this question of why would the Warburgs, who, when you say Warburg, what you really should say is Rothschild. Mm-hmm. If you, the Warburgs, you know, the history of the family, they admit that, well, basically we have been taught and trained and are just an annex of the Rothschild family that we have used for our education and inbreed with all the time, right? So you have to ask yourself, well, wait a second, Hitler comes out with Mein Kampf, which has a lot of really very serious anti-Semitic charges in it in the early 20s, and yet here you have the Rothschild Warburgs funding him in the 30s. What is the explanation for that, you see? And this goes to the point we've made, so I've made a bunch of times, that you have this weird combination all the time of Masons and elite Jewish families. What is responsible for that? You see, what is in back of it? This is the, when you see the Warburgs working with Montague Norman, you have it exactly here in the financial setting, right? The elite Jewish banking family, the Warburg Rothschilds, working with Montague Norman behind the scenes. Norman is supposedly a Gentile, but he is a Freemason. He is a Theosophist. And they're funding the Nazi Party. Why would they do this, you see? But I want to go on because I'm going to now, you know, you have to then remember that as they looked at the world, as the Masons looked at the world in the middle of the 19th century, like 1850. Now, I just want you to, as a thought experiment, Tim, just say, well, what if they, you know, said, well, you know, I really want to reestablish Israel and punish the Gentiles for the war in the first century. This is just something we want to do. How are we going to do that? It's kind of complicated. Well, we're going to have to create nationalism to create, you know, and then we have to get political control over these areas if we want to, like, kind of like create the a war where population is greatly reduced. We also have to create anti-Semitism, at least for a period of time, because otherwise the Jews, who are now inbreeding with the Germans at 60% of their population, they're not going to want to leave a cozy Europe. So how are we going to regenerate this, the racial energy of both the Jews and the Germans? And so, you know, you have at this time the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which people kind of forget how powerful they were. They were actually distributed by, of all things, the Tool Society. Now, this sort of makes sense. I mean, kind of, because the Tool Society is, you know, it's involved in the Aryan superiority, hasn't taken a position really so much on anti-Semitism, but you can kind of see it would make some sense that at least it's not completely incoherent. But they had distributed it following the Russian Revolution to Russian peasants with the idea of stirring up European anti-Semitism. Okay, so they had distributed it. But where does it come from? People talk about where the heck does this thing come from? Well, it actually comes from this person named Yulina Glinka. She was the one who somehow got a copy of it. God only knows. Now, who is she? Well, her grandfather was one of the very few people ever arrested for Freemason conspiracy. This was in Russia. So she comes from a Masonic family. But why would she? When, you know, what is this? The idea of how does she get the protocols? Oh, wait a second. She's also a Theosophist. She's also having meetings after meetings with Helen Blavatsky, right? Now, you have to ask yourself, gee whiz, you got the head of the Bank of England, you got some these guys over in America that are developing the Pledge of Allegiance and American National Socialism, and you also have this woman who comes up with the protocols of the Elders of Zion. They're all theophists and Freemasons. This just doesn't seem like it's possible, because, see, there's no reason for any of these people to actually, actually want to be having this combination. The combination is simply crazy. And so it begs an explanation under any circumstance, but it certainly does today, where we look back at these things and we wonder, well, how could something as crazy as the Aryan racial supremacist Nazi party anti-Semitism fight down to the last German get going? You know, it had this background in this, this strange philosophy. Now, Wikipedia mentioned the Tool Society. Okay, now that's important because you have the occultism, which comes from Blavatsky. She had a follower named, his name was Glauer. He changed his name to Sabatendorf, and he was a Mason, and he then is the one who developed the Nazi Party, as I mentioned. But it wasn't just him. I mean, believe me, there was a lot of different individuals who were developing these ideas at this time. One of them was a guy named Guido von List. Okay, now he's very important because he developed what was called the Wotanism, right? Like the Wotan clan. He also developed the term like Arminism. Now, you won't know these terms if you're not, the development of the Nazis, because these were like proto, kind of Nazi parties that eventually then were swept up by the Tool Society, but were actually distinct, kind of the crazed racial organizations that all were trying to get the Germans to, basically, see this kind of philosophy as coherent. List developed a magazine called Aryosathi, right? It was promoting Wotanism. This was he also had another book called which he called The Blonde and the Masculine, right? So he was just a kind of a crazy guy. Now, oddly enough, he's a Mason, and guess what? He's a theophist. He actually made a very interesting claim. He said that the Arminists and the Rosicrucians and the Freemasons, he says these were all secret teachings that had been given to the Jewish rabbis of Cologne in the hopes of preserving them from Christian persecution. See, he was totally opposed to Christianity. He said these teachings then became the Kabbalah, which he said this is, basically was not a Jewish innovation, but comes from the ancient German Wotanism. You see, they had given the secret teaching to the rabbis, and then they had hidden it and to protect it from Christianity. And then he turned on the Jews and was saying that the Jews were basically the problems that were the cause of all the problems that the German people were having. So he was working with another German theophist, Max Ferdinand. Sorry for all these weird names, but here's where you get back to the origin, because this guy was working with Aleister Crowley,
Who's a British agent.
Right, exactly. But you see, Crowley, you won't believe this, Tim, Crowley gets set in motion by John Yager, just like Helen Blavatsky. He's given the same kind of like a spiritual send-off and description of like you want to get going with this Memphis and Mizraim occultism. So you see, this is why there's this one. There's a couple guys that have done a lot of research into this. One of them is Rex Curry, and the other is, I'm getting old here. He forgets his name, but he is a Jewish scholar who worked for LaRouche.
Steinberg?
Steinberg.
Chaikin? Anton Chaikin?
Yeah, it's Anton, right?
Yeah, he's the one who did with Webster Tarpley, the unauthorized biography of George H.W. Bush.
Exactly.
Where they cover a lot of this material. Yeah.
And he actually has done a lot of research in this area, and I have actually gotten a lot of the details come from his work. He pointed out that, you know, that the Quattro Coronati had been the origin of it. Now, Anton makes a mistake, a clear logical blunder. It's sad because he's a really good scholar, really good information. And he has a YouTube of a speech he gave in 1999, I believe, or 2000, called How the British Empire Brainwashed the World. And he says, don't talk to me about the Illuminati. There's no damn Illuminati. If the Illuminati was so powerful, why didn't they take over the British royal family? Now, Anton is, you know, he doesn't want, and quite often what he'll do is, and I don't think he's a limited hangout. I think he's a very good, legitimate scholar, but he is Jewish. And so he will give a list of all of the things that are leading up to Nazism, and then at the end he'll say, oh, and also there was the Warburg banking family, you know, and he'll say, oh, there was also, you know, Zionism was part of, you know, in other words, he tries to deflect away from Jewish people and Judaism, the you know, their influence inside of this production of it. I don't think, and I think he also does the same thing with the British royal family. He doesn't want something in back of the British royal family to be basically exposed, because he doesn't know what that might lead to. But the fact is his logical error is very transparent, and that the question is, well, how do you know the Illuminati haven't taken over the British royal family?
Isn't the family like Saxe-Gothberg or something?
Yeah, I mean, right. Well, you know, I mean, this is what we have to get the DNA testing, but yeah. The idea that the Illuminati could not have taken over the British royal family is simply preposterous. This would have been, if they are in play at all, would have been one of the primary focuses. The royal family of Britain has been the subject of a torturous, you know, history, with all sorts of different times when different people could have gotten in and taken control of it. So I'm afraid that it is not something that you can just dismiss. And, you know, as I'm going to suggest, is that Freemasonry is basically crypto Jews at the high level, that this was the animating force of these projects, you know. And I would say that history makes no sense. It makes, when you look at the Nazi Party being developed really very clearly by this branch of Freemasonry coming from Quattro Coronati, which is this lodge that is focused and produce Zionism, right? When you see all of these different elements, Garibaldi, Blavatsky, all of these things that are being developed through the lodge that end up being the Nazi Party, coming from the same place that Zionism comes from, and then see that the money is also being developed, right, through this group to fund the Nazi Party, you know, it's just, it becomes history just doesn't make any sense in any other way. Now, people, they wonder, well, you know, wait a second, you know, this is just history unfolding. You know, Blavatsky created Theosophy. You know, there was all these other crackpots that were then influenced, and you get, you know, Guido von Liszt and Max Ferdinand and even Aleister Crowley. Of course, Crowley goes straight back to the Quattro Coronati, but, you know, forgetting that, you know, Hitler then, you know, he took over it, but he was not someone who really, you know, wanted to, you know, stay with the occult. Well, but this is not true. This is the Wikipedia idea, but it was actually studied by Jackson Spiegelvogel and David Redlis, who are from the Simon Wiesenthal Center. These are Simon Wiesenthal appointed scholars. And they studied it, and they said that, in fact, the Blavatsky's book, The Secret Doctrine, and the ideas that came up in this, you know, magazine, Aerosophy, and the Tool Society, that these actually had a decisive influence, supposedly, in what then becomes Adolf Hitler, and that they pointed out that while he publicly condemned and even persecuted occultists, Freemason, and astrologer, his private talks disclose his belief in the ideas of these competing occult groups. So that is from the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Now, he never actually condemned them. I'm going to read you this is from his Nuremberg speech, and this is actually, I think, a pretty good idea about what Adolf Hitler's position was on occultism. He said, this is Hitler speaking, he goes, "We will not allow mystically minded occult folks with a passion for exploring the secrets of the world beyond to steal into our movement. Such folks are not National Socialists, but something else. In any case, something which has nothing to do with us. We thus serve for the maintenance of a divine work and fulfill a divine will, not in the secret twilight of a new house of worship, but openly before the face of the Lord." So in other words, he's not, you know, saying, oh, these people are wrong. He's just saying they're not part of National Socialism. And he doesn't say, when he says, it's very cryptic, he goes, "These folks are not National Socialists, but something else." And then he goes, "In any case," I mean, that's kind of like letting you in on the idea that, you know, obviously Hitler would know that Freemasonry and the Theosophists are in back of his whole movement. But as it then goes on and presents itself to the public, it has to separate from these things, because what's going on, Tim, is simply the process by which the whole operation is hidden. Because so remember, they have to not only get these forces in play, we'll talk about that in a second, but they have to hide it. So you have, you know, you start out at Quattro Coronati, but then they create Theosophy. And then they create, you know, the Tool Society, and only then did they create National Socialism. They could have created it straight out of, you know, the people who developed these ideas back in the Quattro Coronati, but then it would have been too obvious. So they had to do it in a different way, and that's why you had the process take place, you know, starting with Palmerston, and then ending up with the tragic events that, you know, are World War II, because this was, you know, basically started the, you know, this process where Memphis and Mizraim, the cult of John Yarker, which he then gave to both Aleister Crowley and H.P. Blavatsky, ends up as this crazy occultism, which is kind of underlying the German nationalism, and also the Italian nationalism with Mussolini, who was also basically sort of a religious figure. So in other words, what has happened is there is a process by which these quasi-religious figures, who are simply lifetime actors, right? I mean, if you look at Hitler and Mussolini, I mean, in my opinion, it's clear as a bell. They're just as much a lifetime actor as Montague Norman, right? I mean, they are, they're playing their role. And the purpose of the op is just what occurred in history. They're going to reduce population dramatically by holding the armies in place through basically religious leaders, right? That's how, you know, this is all going to end up, and how the power is going to be. You know, this is really an area, and you know, when you go into it, you can see that it hasn't been. You know, there's a lot of really good research that's been done on Quattro Coronati, and Anton has done. You know, he was really the first one, I think, to really get in there. He's done a lot of really good work, but there's so much more that needs to get exposed. I mean, you know, even the character Baphomet, you know, who's so popular in our modern culture, it comes right from this. Mm-hmm. This is where it actually comes from. It comes from this group that is promoting Memphis and Mizraim.
Yeah, when you're watching the Super Bowl and you have Madonna coming down like a Baphomet character, people don't realize that's inspired by the Theosophists. Phil Society, which also created the National Socialism in Germany.
Right. And remember in that episode that the first thing she does is she says, "What are you looking at?" Right. And then you see that she's being pulled, Baphomet is being pulled by Roman soldiers. Mm-hmm. So you can see that some group is now slaves, right? And Baphomet is now in a position of power. I mean, and when she says, "What are you looking at?" she's basically saying, "You don't understand the symbolism."
Yeah. Yeah, so the historical figures like Adolf Hitler, obviously the Hitler of history, the Hitler that we've been given is a caricature, sort of a cutout. It's that supports a certain narrative. Same thing with it. It's kind of funny because both Hitler and Napoleon is obviously people make comparisons between Hitler and Napoleon. Yeah. Both corporals rose. You know, at one point he became an officer, but nevertheless, became the emperor dictator of their respective nations and had these fabulous military victories, conquered Europe, and then invaded Russia in June.
Right.
For ultimate defeat and these things. But Napoleonic Wars, but of course what it did succeed in doing is it led to what's been called Jewish emancipation in the Germanic states.
Sure.
And so you can also see how Hitler's wars, the war against Hitler led, of course, also led to the creation of Israel, the Israeli state. And so, these figures are serving some sort of function. Napoleon also, he's also turned over the control of the French bank to the Rothschilds. And it was during his reign that the Rothschilds became ascendant.
And just remember that even though, you know, they say, well, where's the evidence for Napoleon being a Mason? You have these pictures of him with the hidden hand. All of his brothers were well-known Masons. And then he's supposed to be a Gentile, but then he hands over the banking power of France to the Rothschild. I mean, this is a repeat of what happened with Cecil Rhodes.
And Hitler never openly criticized the Rothschild banking family, if I recall.
Not once.
And in fact, he left their banks unmolested in France. He didn't.
Well, this exactly right. And why would the Warburg Rothschild banking entities cooperate with Montague Norman to fund Hitler after 1921, when Mein Kampf had been published? Once the book was out, it could be studied and people would go, you know, this could end up badly for Jews. Mm-hmm. So there is the Wikipedia description you gave is sort of, it's a narrative, but it cannot possibly explain the relationship between Freemason theosophy, the Jewish banking families, the skull and bones participation through Brown Brothers, and then, you know, on into World War II. It just doesn't really have any explanatory power.
Yeah, and you also have there's this book, I think it's Hitler Was a British Agent, written about, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And it pretty much says that Hitler was sort of this, mind-controlled zombie who was controlled by British intelligence. I think it was based on, like, his his sister-in-law or something, and Hitler actually was in England before World War One or something. I don't know if that's true.
There was a claim that I don't know if it has been vetted, but that he actually had meetings with these people. And so then the idea was that they had controlled him through MK Ultra. But I would go beyond that and say, well, wait a second. Why would they need to control him if he's a lifetime actor?
Well, that's I've never seen any evidence of that claim.
Right.
It's a fantastic story. But I think that Hitler, someone like a Napoleon Hitler, they play their roles. They're set up for this. And
that's how the system works. Yeah. I mean, it certainly is working that way in the United States now. And I just wanted to say another thing. Okay, you've got Mein Kampf, which supposedly is like written by this, I don't know what his education is purported. But if you look at it, it has a certain style. It's what I would call hyper-rational. In other words, every paragraph virtually has a kind of a position sentence and then some rationale and then this kind of pithy little logical conclusion. And this just goes on and on and on. The thing is just as boring as can be. Well, this also appears in the Protocols for the Elder of Zion. The same kind of weird, like rational, hyper-rational, I call them. This very strange style, which I think is actually a committee writing. And then it certainly reappears with The Secret Doctrine.
then it becomes bestseller.
Yeah. I mean, bestseller. But the thing is like, if you look at the writing styles of, the Protocols, Mein Kampf, Das Kapital. I mean, there is what I call this kind of, it's hard to describe, but I just get there's a sense that it's really not serious. I mean, it's obviously sophistry, but it's that they have developed a kind of style to appear rational. And I mean, the most of those books, the most insane is not the Protocols, which, it's actually pretty straightforward kind of, it's a historical thesis, whatever the truth of the thing is, it's not occultism. But the really weird one is Blavatsky's. It's like 700 pages long. And I mean, it has all of these, just minute details about astrology and occult origins of races and ideas. And it's just the most crazed thing imaginable. And yet it has this veneer of hyper-rationality, and it's 700 pages long. Why in the hell would anyone even write such a thing, And I think that my sense is, if this is an op, and I am convinced it is, that there's actually a literary committee. It may not produce all the literature, but has some kind of method of editing and making sure that this style is maintained because it pleases them to appear to be rational.
Yeah, and something like a Mein Kampf or Blavatsky's work, these things provide a literature for people who are going to be triggered by the circumstances created by the secret society.
Right.
Like Madison Grant's Passing of the Great Race, I think it was like early 20th century, 1910 or something. And it's funny how these things are sort of, they're almost anticipating the following events, like they have some sort of inside information on what's going to happen.
Right.
And obviously the crisis of 1920s Germany and the people responsible for exploiting Germany, a lot of these were bankers and Jews and these things. So that's going to trigger sort of this hyper-nationalism Germany, which will then be used to discredit ethno-nationalism. And who wants to do that? Well,
right. Well, exactly. And again, when you talk about kind of the foreseeing, I mean, Blavatsky is actually, I mean, she's like the BBC presenter who could see, Building 7 collapse, because she talked about how, this world religious leader would have to emerge, to lead the Aryan people.
Now, did Blavatsky ever meet Montague Norman? Was she ever in physical presence of him? Do we know? Or
no. I do not. There's no evidence of that. Okay. There is evidence that the woman who developed the Protocols of Zion met with Blavatsky many times. There's actually letters and documents to show that. But Montague, he was in the Psychical Research Society with Balfour, and he simply admitted, he says, I'm a theophist.
Well, one thing that always struck me, and that you see, and this is reported in conventional historical you know, the conventional narrative of World War II in that period is that Helmut Schacht was good friends with Montagu Norman, and he was Hitler's banker up until the outbreak of, the war. And
how can that be? Exactly. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense, because remember, this is a whole decade after Mein Kampf, which just basically outlines the fact that Hitler is crazed. And you shouldn't be if you are a sophisticated banker. And this guy is like a third generation. I mean, he's the head of the Bank of England for decades. He knows what he's doing. He wouldn't be funding something like this. There would be some kind of pushback. And yet he just goes forward time and time and time again. Whenever they need money, it just pops up. And he so often is in line with the Warburgs, Rothschilds.
Yeah, it's also why IG Farben's plants were never bombed during the war.
Exactly, because they were, as I would characterize them, they were just owned by the group that was creating Israel, creating the Nazi Party, creating World War II. They created the nationalism in Italy and Germany because the religious leaders, right? So that's why you have Blavatsky talking about, you've got to have this every few generations of a world religious person will emerge to lead us, you know.
Mystical nationalism.
And exactly.
That's how you get a Nuremberg rally going, right?
That's right. You got it. This is what's going on. She's putting, and it's taking years to create these concepts, so they're strong enough in the culture they can actually make use of.
In America, they had Manifest Destiny. That was another Rothschild meme, I think.
You know. Yeah, that's right.
I guess Belmont.
Justify slaughtering, the genocide of the Indians. Yeah. And so you when you're going to genocide, you need your mysticism. And this is what Blavatsky's doing. It's what Guido von Liszt is doing. It's why Montagu Norman is a theophist. It's why Jalinka, the Protocol of the Elder Zion person, is a theophist. And theophist means, God knowledge, right? That's what the term means.
Because ultimately, it's Luciferianism, I guess.
Well, of course.
Because, you become like God.
Because this is, you wonder, why would they, God knowledge? What is the basis? Particularly when you read Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine, which, as I said, is unreadable. It's completely, it's just beyond crackpot. And yet, it then supposedly...
Apparently, God knowledge doesn't give you the ability to write a good prose.
he's not good. He's not a grammarian. But somehow this crackpot gets the head of the Bank of England to be a follower, and the National Socialists in America who also becomes a follower. In other words, when you see how the Nazi Party is assembled, and you see it isn't just Freemasonry, because it is. But it's also this one brand, and that must have been, from the Quattro Coronati on, the organizing group. That's why you can actually work back and see how each one of these people is related, in this very specific philosophical strand.
Yeah, this is very interesting, and I guess for many people it may seem a little esoteric or hard to grasp.
Sorry,
But yeah. This is how it's playing out, because you have to put this in the historical perspective. This is also how does this work into something like the Mackinder Doctrine, which is the doctrine of the occult octopus we call the British Empire. Well, you can see how the Mackinder Doctrine is to weaken, to control the center of the of Europe. Eurasia is the key to controlling the world, and the way you do that, you destabilize those countries there, and that would be Russia, primarily Russia and Germany. And, well, you see how this can be used to set Germany up to be ultimately destabilized and conquered and controlled by the occult powers, by Leviathan, the British Empire. Obviously, this is also how a similar process was followed, during the First World War and the aid that was given to the Bolsheviks, courtesy London, Germany, German Warburg family in New York with the Jacob Schiff. And so we see this pattern here. But you know, also with Germany, so take Germany for case. We're talking about, you know, the rise of the Nazis and these things, and they've been portrayed as being, you know, just an evil force, a spawn of Satan, almost a warped crackpot ideology, no validity whatsoever. That's not necessarily true. The reason is the conditions that the occult banker Theosophist created would create legitimate grievances within Germany. The collapse of the German economy, the great inflation, the cultural degradation, the cultural assault that was waged against Germany in the 1920s. This would create the reaction. And if you look at some of the things that some of these even Goebbels said about the Allied powers was very true. Whether it's the banking practices, usury, and these things. So there are some of the economic critique of Western economics, and there are some measures that were followed in Germany which appeared to work. And now it's hard to assess, to judge the economics of Germany. I think it was Fedor is his name, because Germany was at war for half. I mean, for half the life of the Third Reich, Germany was at war. And how do you judge an economy when it's at war? You know, but nevertheless, they did seem to solve the unemployment problem, and they created sort of a national consciousness and purpose in these things. And the irony is that now, if there's ever any ethnic group that wants to have a state that isn't Jewish, it's considered racist, or even not, you're being a Nazi, and it cannot be tolerated. So much so that, you know, you have the former head of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization saying that the end of the age of the ethnostate is over.
Yeah, you know, as thanks if, a lot.
You know,
sorry.
I'm just saying that yet what's happening here is, again, they've created conditions where they can predict the reaction, and they can trigger people, and they can and they control the reaction. Well, it's problem reaction solution, right? And which is Masonic,
right? And I just wanted to underline what you had said, that the prosperity that led up to Hitler's absolute control over the German people was as deliberately manufactured as the financial catastrophe of the Weimar had been, yeah. Right? If you actually look at, you know, how central banks had arranged all of this in conjunction with, the governments, the Versailles Treaty and the mm-hmm. way that crush the Germans following World War
I. So the Dawes plan, the Young plan, and these things.
But then when Hitler comes to power, now they want to create authority because he is their puppet, or he's in their deal. Mm-hmm. And so now prosperity occurs. And so now you have fanatical loyalty to Hitler, because the Germans, who are being assembled as a nation, right, are thinking, look, this guy is taking us to a better place, right? He deserves our loyalty. This is and now the loyalty is all going to get used for one single purpose, and that's genocide. This pattern just happens in history so many times. You look at Marxism, right? You have the workers' paradise. The people think it's going to go great. They're going to, like, you know, distribute the wealth of the oligarchs, and then the next thing you know, the political control is given to a small group, and lo and behold, they're malevolent, and now you're in trouble. Because once you've given political control to these individuals, they control the military, the finance, and if they are malevolent, if they seek you ill, man, it's easy for them to do it, you see. And this is why history just never works out right for us. You know what I mean? It always, no matter what we do, it ends up bad, because this organization has slithered into the positions of political power. And from there, they control the finances, and they control the future. They can create conditions in which the public fanatically will give every bit of love to an individual leader. And then if he takes them off a cliff, they won't complain.
Yeah, I remember at the same time, the United States was supposedly being led by their own dictator named Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yeah, right.
And the National Recovery Act and these things were very fascistic. And they followed the same models, roughly. It's just that maybe the German system was more authoritarian, overtly. This was the so you have fought, you know, they both came to power roughly the same time.
And it's just, you know, I just wanted to also underline the idea that when you have, you know, the Warburgs, you know, they were the leading stockholder of IG Farben. which was then basically, you know, was going to be creating most of the Nazi war machine, right? It's the largest industry in company in Germany. And it's, in fact, it was once described as an international Jewish organization. But nevertheless, Schott was able to get the money through Montague Norman to produce some munitions and chemical for the military buildup. But it was during this period, this was all the way up to like 1938, mm-hmm. that the Warburg Rothschilds are basically funding, and Max Warburg, who as his the autobiography or the biography of the Warburg family, you know, makes clear, is just a representative of the Rothschild. He's the leading stockholder of IG Farben. This is 20 or 15 years after Mein Kampf, and this is during the time when all of the munitions are being developed. What? How can this possibly, under the narrative of history that we've been given, make any sense? And I just wanted to go back one generation, because when you get into this weird combination of the Masons, Skull and Bones, and Jews, you have to remember that the Warburg family, they had a bank, which was called Kuhn Loeb, right? So you've got Warburgs, Kuhn Loeb. These are elite Jewish families, mm-hmm. Banking families. It's all just, again, it's Rothschild, because they all have these connections back into that banking family. But they were the ones that unified with Harriman to create the railroads in the United States. And they were using money that then had been you know, gained or loaned from the British central banks, right? Mm-hmm. And so now in the 30s, On the behest of Warburg, Kuhn Loeb was still selling bonds in New York for Hitler and Schott. Right? I mean, this is just beyond belief. This is like literally right up to the invasion of Poland. These guys are financing him, knowing full well what he is, his anti-Semitism. It's all out there in Mein Kampf. So it makes no sense, but it does if you look at it as the operation, right? Yeah. That they've created exactly the right conditions to now have the religious leader in control of both Germany and Italy, who are going to be punished for the crimes of the first century, right? Perhaps this is my idea. And they will be held in place, and the Masonic armies, you know, the U.S., the Russians, and then, sadly, the Germans and Italy's, who were also under control, will simply slaughter one another, and you'll have a new Europe after World War II.
Yeah, this also explains something like the firebombing.
Makes perfect sense. Dresden. This is the thing, and you're not going to see this in Wikipedia. I think it's probably going to be a while, don't you, Tim, before Wikipedia will pick up any of these ideas. But, you know, as I hope I have been able to make clear, when you trace this amazing strand from the Quattro Coronati Research Lodge that creates anti-Semitism, it creates the State of Israel, it creates the Nazi Party, and then it creates the funding for the Nazi Party, right? I mean, all of these individuals seem to be working in a unified whole. When you see that, then history makes perfect sense. So I just want to say that this thesis really deserves more attention, because, Tim, it has real explanatory power, right? World War II, the creation of the Nazi Party, man, there's just so many holes in the historical narration. The whole thing makes no sense. I mean, the firebombing at the end, Eisenhower's death camp for the German soldiers, all of the problems with believing the historical narrative of the Holocaust. You know, Holocaust, we've done shows on that. Yeah. You know, talked about, well, what the heck's going on? And it doesn't quite add up. The numbers don't add up. The people look to be propagandists. The shrunken heads are props. I mean, this looks like an operation, not like a real historical tragedy. What theory explains everything?
I was reading a thing is back in 1994, Phil Donahue had just seen Schindler's List. And on his TV show, he said, "How can anyone doubt the Holocaust now?"
Yeah, I know. I mean, gosh. I mean,
I saw a movie. It was in black and white.
There it is. I mean, after that, it's just so powerful, right? It's sort of like, how can anyone doubt bin Laden was killed after Zero Dark 30? I mean, this is where, you know, the pixelated world, brother, it's we have to, you know, always keep our humanity intact and remember that this is fake. It's a screen. And people know how to manipulate it. So we have to try
Yeah, I mean, we hear, report, you know, obviously it's now known that during the war, Standard Oil made sure that the German Air Force had aviation fuel. They also helped them develop synthetic fuel. That's what largely was, at least was reported going on at Auschwitz, the Buna Works. These are, you know, this... over there, they were developing a synthetic fuel from their coal, but they apparently the Standard Oil actually had the patent and the technology to do that. You had IBM operating out of Auschwitz. These things, AT&T, I think, had SS officers on its board being paid throughout the war. All these things going on throughout the war, and all these business transactions.
Nothing makes any sense.
Ford, I think,
unless. They're working together as an operation.
Yeah, you know? Ford supplied trucks to both the Soviets and the Germans during the war. Same thing, General Motors. I think their subsidiary Opel, produced the tanks, the Tiger tanks. And all these. So I mean, now you could say these are business interests that continue throughout the war, and there's no reason to break those off and everything. But I think it's something more than that. Never, even still, it says a lot about the true nature of these wars. If people are going to war and foreign borders being asked to go, die in the Pacific, some rock in the Pacific, or some die in some trench or some foxhole in France or something. Yet businessmen can't rearrange their business deals.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait a second here. Come on. It just had killed a lot of people. I mean, and the wars themselves are, I think, last week we talked about foundations. Of course, we have what Kathryn Casey found out about the Carnegie Foundation talking about war being the principal way to fundamentally change the nation. And just the trauma of people that goes on during the economic changes that occurred during the war. The cartelization and centralization that occurs, a good example is during World War II. American industry was the federal government paid almost $40 billion to rebuild, retool, recapitalize large American industries. They got wealthy from it, so that's a fundamentally shifting of wealth to these large corporations. To create the arsenal of democracies. Supposedly, nevertheless, they were enriched. The airline industry up until World War II was sort of like a craft, and the large airlines were a product of World War II because they hundreds of thousands of airplanes were built during the Second World War, and from that grew these large airlines like TWA, which was Howard Hughes, and Howard Hughes had always had a connection to U.S. intelligence and these things, and he got enormously wealthy from that, that's how these vast fortunes are created. These cartels are created.
Exactly. There's the op, the historical, whatever that they're going to bring about. But then they also, because they know it's going to happen, foreknowledge, they just make a fortune.
The Remington was
control. They have the military control where they're wiping us out, reducing population, and then that leads to greater concentration of wealth in their hands. Where now they have financial control, where they enslave us basically through the control of the companies.
And then they buy the media, and they control perception. And a good example is, I think it was Samuel Bush, who started the Remington Arms Corporation, making firearms. He went to work for the War Industries Board under Bernard Baruch. So he's working for Bernard Baruch. And then in the 20s, it was the Remington Remington Arms Company, which supplies the guns for the SA, Rome's SA, for the street fighting, which has its own political consequences because you want to stir them up. I'm sure they funded the communists as well, so they wanted the street fighting because the street fighting led to the disorder, which ultimately led to the legitimization of Adolf Hitler, because it was that disorder which led Paul von Hindenburg to appoint Hitler chancellor. People forget that Hitler – you know, came to power legally. He was appointed. Yeah. And then there was the Reichstag fire, which people still don't know. Some people just assume the Nazis did because they benefited from it politically. But nevertheless, that, you know, that leads to the Enabling Act, and which is the legal foundation for the Hitlerian regime, which ultimately, you know, lasts until 1945.
Well, you know, Tim, I mean, these guys can just see in the future, you know? It's just amazing, isn't it? You know, I mean, it's like there she was, this insane occult crackpot in 1889.
It's her crystal ball.
And she goes, you know, the purpose of the Society of Theosophy, this is Helen Blavatsky writing, she goes, you know, we have to prepare humanity for the reception of a world teacher, right, who will appear on Earth in order to direct mankind. Wow. This is the broad who then developed the 45-degree-angled swastika and talked about the Aryan race existing and its superiority over inferior races. Isn't it amazing in 1899 that she could think about a world teacher who was there to direct mankind? Now, gee, kind of looks like Adolf Hitler to me, or how he would have been characterizing himself. And it's a little odd that Blavatsky could see that in the future, see? So this is, it all adds up to a very clear picture, just a very ugly one.
Yeah. I mean, she, I've heard a lot of people write her off as sort of a crackpot, a con, these things. And but she casts a very long shadow. It's almost like Aleister Crowley, where he, you know, he's a deviant, he's in his black magic, he's kind of a con man and these things. Nevertheless, he cast a very long shadow over the 20th century, politically and culturally.
Sure. And that's the thing is that's right. She is a crackpot. And
that's the
nothing
point. Yeah.
About her philosophy is legitimate. What people don't understand is that she's a sophist, that these are just clever arguments that she's using to develop to create the philosophical platforms upon which you know, authority over a people can exist.
Yeah, this is similar to like how a Kinsey or a Ginsburg is promoted in these things.
Exactly. Yeah, she just seems like a crackpot. But then you go, well, wait a second. She's a crackpot, but then how come Montague Norman is her follower? I mean, he's the head of the Bank of England. He's funding the Nazi Party. That doesn't look like a crackpot to me. Well, how about Julina, the woman who ends up discovering the protocols, the old designer, that's hardly the work of a crackpot to bring about something so historically significant. Well, wait a second. What about the guys in the U.S. who developed national socialism, the flag, the arm? I mean, all of this stuff. They're her followers as well. She's a crackpot? I'm sorry. I don't see her as a crackpot. I mean, her ideas are crazy. But what I see is a very powerful cultural force, you know, shaping, moving Europe toward World War II.
Well, that's why we got the 20th century.
Yeah, crackpot. But, oh, wait a second. Let's not let the crackpot facade take away from the fact that she was at the center of the organization that brought about the genocide of World War II.
Yeah, because you would need crazy ideas for that to go. Because no sane person, if sane people were in charge, you wouldn't have gotten, a Stalingrad, you wouldn't have gotten a Dresden,
you wouldn't have had the loyalty to Hitler, if you hadn't had the blend of the desperate situation following World War I that was ripe for these occult ideas. Right, everything came together so that, as Blavatsky wrote, this world leader could come forward, right?
And it was an important counterpoint or opposite. That is what we talked about a few weeks here regarding the final solution to the German question. Was the idea of destroying Germany and letting that out, because that would stiffen German resolve to keep on fighting. The Morgenthau report and these things.
The Morgenthau report, exactly. I mean, Tim, it's like I always say, man, the Gentile can't get a break. And, you know, the thing is, what's really weird is that Hitler is, you know, there's this kind of fad where the alt-right is like kind of, you know, glomming onto him as some kind of a hero, right? Because he fought against what they see as unreasonable Jewish interests, you know, and that he was, you know, not politically correct and, you know, that he's been lied about. There's all of this stuff.
Yeah, he's the standing athwart to the New World Order or something.
Yeah. Right, but, you know, but then you go, well, wait a second, guys. None of these people believe in the Holocaust, at least as far as I can tell. They tend to doubt it anyway. They question it. Okay, well, now let's look at Hitler in that light. Say the Holocaust was far fewer deaths than, you know, has been reported. Say it was like 100,000 or something that died and there wasn't any, you know, there's just all this propaganda following. Let's just take that as a theory. Well, now look at Hitler. What did he do? Matt, he was responsible for the deaths of more Gentiles than anyone had ever lived, you see.
Yeah, because he sent 5 million of them into Russia.
Yeah. Well, and then he ends up with Hamburg, Dresden, all of the carnage that the Allies are doing is because he's not surrendering, because he's not waging the war rationally. I mean, you're talking like 100 million Europeans are going to die one way or another because of a part of what this guy does. Mm-hmm. So why is he some sort of a hero? Well, he fought against the Jew. Where? He didn't fight against the Jew when he was developing his munitions. He was taking money straight from the Warburg banking interest.
His Einstein Gruppen or his soldiers went in and, you know, I guess in the course of invading Russia, massacred a lot of them or created conditions where many were massacred. So the little Jew was being murdered or being
right.
in concentration camps, but they're not the ones guilty of anything.
Right.
It was the banking families
trying to live their lives.
Yeah.
And these huge forces are sweeping them up just like everyone else. But then after the war, they get used for propaganda purposes.
Yeah, and then they're told a certain narrative.
They become like the shrunken head that was there for the reporters to see when they came in, to the concentration camp.
Yeah, they're suckers that join the IDF and then persecute Palestinians.
Yeah. So you know they're getting played in the same way that they're getting played in the same way that everyone else is getting played, mm-hmm. you know. But it's just I think we have enough we've given enough information so that what I'm hoping is we can stimulate more research. I really want to, you know, it's hard for just you and I with limited time and whatnot to go through all this stuff. But I really think that the fad of Hitler as some kind of, someone who stood up against the New World Order is misplaced. And I think that people really need to start studying the relationship between the Nazi Party and theosophy.
Yeah.
Because that's going to take him back to British Freemasonry, and then when you make that path, then suddenly you can see that World War II doesn't look organic; it just looks like an organized culling of a racial herd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it wasn't a clash between good and evil; it was just evil.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. It was just evil. And so anyway, I don't know. I think we've given them some information tonight, Tim.
Great. Yeah. It's it's a different take on it, which is,
yeah,
you don't see in many history books, but yeah, there's sort of the occult origins of Nazism.
Well, and the Freemason control over the production of it and the possibility that it was an operation. That you're looking at like 9-1-1 or something like that.
Yeah,
looking,
I mean, Carol Quigley, I did a number of talks with last year with Jay Dyer because he studied Tragedy and Hope, and he Quigley kind of admits this, that the wars of the 20th century, of course, he's writing in 1966, so he's writing in the middle of the Cold War, but pretty much what happened was the Anglosphere, the Anglo establishment, waged the First World War to create a tripolar world, I guess you could say. And then they supported the rise of Hitler. I mean, the First World War was to create a tripolar world, which would create the conditions for the Second World War. And when that was waged and won, it created the bipolar world. And then the bipolar world creates the unipolar world.
Yeah.
And now we have the New World Order. So that's, so these things are all kind of orchestrated.
Yeah, Anton, he explains I can't pronounce his last name, it's not in my head, but Anton, the La Roche scholar, what's his last name?
Chetkin.
Chetkin, thank you. Well, Anton, he takes the position that it's British geopolitics, that this is just the British imperial family, they are the source of evil,
Which isn't incorrect, it's insufficient.
No. But it's just the problem is it kind of replaces one mystery with another. And the thing is that we can identify that strand of Freemasonry as the source of it, but we just don't know who they are. And I think the idea that they're cryptos is a powerful explanatory position. It just, everything just makes perfect sense at that point. And that's why I think it's just, there's certainly enough here for, more study to be done, and hopefully we can move the people on the alt-right who are interested in this fad about Adolf Hitler back to some more kind of core research, so that we don't have to go through that war again.
Because, well, so they don't get triggered like Hitler.
Yes. Well, if Hitler was triggered, I mean, See, this is the thing. He disappears at the end of the war. He sure looks like a lifetime actor to me. And there's a lot of character, as I look at all these details, I just say, man, this Hitler guy, he's just an obvious lifetime actor. And then they just pulled him off the stage at the end, because that was the agreement.
Maybe he was Charlie Chaplin.
Just like the John Lennon, look like.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly. Who knows? Because the pixelated world, they have a sense of humor. It's easy to imagine. Who knows? I mean, what happens to the guy? But the character that he represented, I think, was fake. It was a stagecraft. He was just there to be this religious, this world ruler that Blavatsky had talked about. And
well, listen, just a little, get a little practical or real about this. No, I guess the closest to a real dictator ever was maybe Joseph Stalin. But even then, but Hitler, I mean, yeah, you have the man, the dictator, but beneath him, you have all these, even the normal historians will say there's different factions fighting it out. He's not in control of everything. It's a question of who can get Hitler's attention at the time. So there's all types of different agendas being pursued throughout the Third Reich and inside government and these things. This happens in any government. So any leader, he's not going to be really, the guy making all the decisions, because he simply doesn't have enough hands or brain power to do that. So he's right. He's going to be manipulated by some sort of oligarchy anyway at some point.
Yeah, well, I mean, Hitler had only one thing he had to, absolutely had to do, and that was not surrender.
Yeah.
He just had to not surrender and just, we're going to fight down to the last man.
I know. I blame Ricardo Wagner. So,
God almighty.
So, well, Joe, I think we
I think we got a pretty good handle on it. And
you think we confused enough people tonight?
I think this one will really confuse people. And so please contact him or myself if you have any questions about it. We'll get them next week.
Well, let's Joe. Thanks a lot. Thanks
so much,
Tim. Enjoy your weekend.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.